Much has been written about the pursuit of SMS Goeben and Breslau, or Breslau maybe, which ultimately ended with them becoming a major factor in the Ottomans entering World War I on the side of the Germans, and thus that particular chase set in motion events that would lead eventually to the Gallipoli campaign. However, today we're going to focus on one particular element, the almost interception of the German ships by Rear Admiral Troubridge and a squadron of British armoured cruisers. A huge amount has also been written about this, arguing back and forth about what Troubridge should have done, a controversy that actually started pretty much the moment he took the decision. As you might have guessed from almost interception, he chose not to engage, and it's never really stopped since. So first we're going to look at what happened historically and why, as well as considering some factors that we know nowadays and can apply with hindsight. And the reason for that is that regardless of what people might have thought at the time, if he had chosen to engage Goeben, which obviously was one of his options, then the material facts, which we know now, would in fact be what mattered during that engagement. And finally, we're going to examine what might have happened if the engagement had actually taken place, had he gone ahead with his planned interception. So, by way of quick background, Admiral Souchon, aboard Goeben, had been running all over the place since relationships between the European powers had begun to spiral in the aftermath of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Matters were complicated by the fact that there were five relevant powers involved in one way, shape, or form in the central Mediterranean: the British, the French, the Italians, the Austro-Hungarians, and finally, in the form of Goeben and Breslau, the Germans. The reason this was quite complicated was that despite there notionally being two sides, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente, neither side actually expressed their diplomatic intents as a fully united front. Thus, Italy would declare neutrality for now, despite theoretically having been on the side of Austria-Hungary and Germany. And that meant that neither British and French nor German or Austro-Hungarian ships could stay in Italian ports for more than 24 hours without being interned, but it also meant that the Italian battle fleet was off the table. The lack of diplomatic unity meant that for the remaining four powers, declarations of war between them came individually. Already, this had cost the Allies a major opportunity, since France was already at war with Germany when Admiral Milne's battlecruisers had sailed past Goeben, going in the opposite direction. Although the British ships were on their way to guard French troop convoys against possible attack by the Germans, they weren't allowed to engage at that point because Britain itself was not yet at war with Germany, and so at that stage their rules of engagement said they could only fire if they were fired upon, and Souchon wasn't an idiot and he wasn't going to fight a 3-on-1 close-in engagement. The belated official opening of hostilities between Britain and Germany thus came when Goeben was well to the east of Milne's forces. Milne was, for the minute, still convinced the Germans would either come for the French troop convoys heading for France from North Africa, or they might make a break for the Atlantic, and so he decided to keep his ships between Sicily and the French shipping lanes. However, the light cruiser Gloucester was sent to find and shadow the Germans, while the light cruiser Dublin was sent to find and reinforce Troubridge, who was cruising at the bottom end of the Adriatic, just in case the Austro-Hungarians came out to help the Germans, despite Britain having yet to declare war on Austria-Hungary. Into this mix came orders from Churchill and the Admiralty not to become engaged with what they described as a superior force, although exactly what that meant was left deliberately unclear. Post-war, Churchill would write that he clearly meant he didn't want that Milne's battlecruisers and his associated forces to try and fight the entire Austro-Hungarian fleet with its mix of dreadnought and pre-dreadnought battleships if said fleet came out. But to what extent that's true and to what extent this was post hoc justification, I'll leave you to decide. In any case, it was in no way qualified to mean specifically don't fight the Austrian fleet, and so Milne and Troubridge were left to work out for themselves what may or may not constitute a superior force at any given time. On the 5th of August, Gloucester reported that the Germans were at Messina, the narrow straits between Italy and Sicily. The Germans were stopping there to get more coal, although of course thanks to strict enforcement of neutrality laws they only had 24 hours to do so. Troubridge, however, thought that the reports of Goeben in the Straits of Messina meant that she was actually sailing through without stopping, and assumed that she was making a dash for the Adriatic to try and join up with the Austro-Hungarians. Well aware that the 11-inch guns on the German battlecruiser outranged his own 9.2 and 7.5-inch batteries, he intended to fight a night action in close waters to minimise the range advantage. At this point, he possessed four armoured cruisers: Defence, Black Prince, Warrior, and Duke of Edinburgh. All had a broadside of four 9.2-inch guns, but thanks to differing design theories influencing the various classes, the secondary batteries ranged from 10 single 6-inch guns on Black Prince and Duke of Edinburgh, which of course meant five of these could bear per side, to four single 7.5-inch on Warrior, of which two could bear on either broadside, and 10 single 7.5-inch guns on Defence, of which five could bear per side, plus of course they all had torpedoes if they managed to get to close range. All the cruisers had a maximum belt armour thickness of 6 inches and a notional top speed of 23 knots, although one of the ships was known to be a relatively poor steamer and all of them had been out and about for a while, although whether the poor steamer was Warrior or Duke of Edinburgh depends on which source you read. This meant that there was actually a top speed of around 20 knots if they wanted to stay together in battle, and around 18 knots for high-speed cruising. Thanks to differing gun layouts, Defence could bring two of her main guns to bear, fore or aft, while the others could actually bring three to bear if they were heading directly for a target, thanks to the rest all using six single 9.2-inch guns, one fore, one aft, and two on each wing, as compared to Defence's more efficient pair of twin turrets, one fore, one aft, hence the much larger secondary battery. Trowbridge also had with him eight destroyers, although these had been about to head to Malta to refuel, but then with war with Austria-Hungary likely to be declared very soon, Milne had ordered the destroyers to stay with Trowbridge and instead await a collier that was being organised. He also ordered that in the event of a night attack, the destroyers were to be sent in first, which made a degree of sense. And so on the evening of the 5th, Trowbridge and his forces sailed to intercept the Germans with a relatively coherent plan of action. The cruisers would fire in salvos only, which would minimise the number of times that guns would flash and thus give away their positions. The searchlights would be manned, but would only be turned on when Defence, the flagship, opened fire, at which point all relevant searchlights would be used to try and dazzle the enemy. Once the enemy was under fire and illuminated, again using only salvo firing, the destroyers could move in for a torpedo attack. However, of course, the Germans weren't heading for the Adriatic. They were actually frantically loading coal in the port at Messina. Their crews, along with the crews of several German merchant ships who were in the port, were helping out to load as much coal, and the German merchant ships also providing some men, albeit that the coal that they could offer was of pretty terrible quality. Milne, meanwhile, remained convinced that the Germans were in fact going to come about for the French transports, and so he made no particular move to close the distance, although he, of course, could have used this 24 hours to essentially box Goeben in at Messina, which would have rendered her unable to leave without a direct confrontation. Heaped onto this chaos was the fact that when Milne's messages of support reached the French were incredulous, and they replied, "They've got their whole fleet with the transports. They didn't need any help." Instead, they actually offered Milne the services of four French cruisers, who otherwise were getting very bored for lack of anything to do, to go and attack Souchon. Despite these messages and offers, Milne remained weirdly obsessed with safeguarding the French transports, even when it was clear the French didn't actually want him, and he kept all three battlecruisers with him. Finally, on the 6th, Goeben emerged from Messina as the herald of something of an environmental war crime, the awful coal in her hold causing her to emit vast plumes of smoke that more resembled a burning waste dump than the output of a ship, and so Gloucester began to shadow her with a degree of ease. It wasn't exactly difficult to spot where Goeben was. At this point, though, there was some confusion about exactly how fast Goeben could actually go, and this confusion has been perpetuated in some secondary sources as time has gone on. On her trials, Goeben had actually reached a top speed of almost 28 knots, albeit in the highly contrived circumstances that were common with German speed trials of the time, against her design speed of a fraction over 25 knots. However, she had been out and about in the Mediterranean for a while, and her machinery as a result was in a pretty dreadful state. Not long ago, she'd barely been able to cruise at 14 to 16 knots, and it was only after a rather heroic set of efforts that involved taking aboard thousands of fresh boiler tubes and replacing many of the old ones by cycling boilers on and off, some of this work being done while the ship was at sea, that had seen her speed be partially restored. But exactly how fast she could now go remained a mystery to many at the time. Some attributed her with a speed of 26 knots or more, which was patently ludicrous. Others claimed that she was able to go at 24 knots, still others that 22, with 24 knots in short bursts, and still others said that she might be able to do about 20 knots, with 24 in short bursts. Souchon himself would actually later write in his memoirs that his ship at this point could struggle along at about 18 knots, and only then, with heroic efforts in the boiler room, including four men who died from steam leaks and heat exhaustion, partially due to the fact that not all boiler tubes had been replaced, partly due to fouling on the ship, and partly due to machinery wear, and also partly due to the fact that the coal was frankly awful, as we've mentioned, and wasn't really giving all that much power. Note that this range of between 18 and 26 knots, or shall we say 18 and bursts of 24, which is perhaps more realistic, meant that, depending on which figure you pick, Goeben was either considerably faster than Trowbridge, or somewhat faster, or barely faster, or the same speed, and occasionally could maybe manage a little bit quicker in short bursts, or he was actually just flat out slower. Coupled with the various known issues in her boilers that suggested that pushing them really hard, like, say, in battle when you might want to get away, might cause catastrophic failure, Goeben was a little bit of a Schrödinger's machinery plant. Just exactly what she could do, and for how long, was something of a mystery to everyone, including her own commander. In any case, after some time jockeying with Breslau, which tried to make her go away, Gloucester had settled in to trail Goeben at a steady 18 knots. So Goeben could make at least that speed, and probably not hugely more, otherwise they probably would have used it to escape Gloucester's scouting. Now, early in the night of the 6th, the cruiser Dublin and the destroyers Beagle and Bulldog managed to get close to someone, and they were prepared to hit it with torpedoes. But as they got closer still, they concluded that the ship they'd found was Breslau, which was slightly detached at this point, and wanting to save their torpedoes for a bigger target, they went onwards to find Goeben, but this was to no avail. Trowbridge, meanwhile, faced something of a quandary. Having burnt a fair amount of coal in the abortive sortie into the Adriatic the previous night, he spent most of the 6th expecting to receive a collier, or some of Milne's battlecruisers, or both, but got neither. Shortly after 1800 that evening, he then received news that Goeben was on the move and headed vaguely his way. So he decided to try a night attack again under similar circumstances, only now off the Greek coast instead of the Italian one. But now he had a problem. His 8 destroyers, which had started out the previous day already short of fuel and had come out with him the previous night, were now incredibly short on coal since the collier had yet to arrive. Indeed, after much delay in Malta, the ship had only actually left Malta that afternoon, and at a grand top speed of 8 knots, she wasn't due to reach Trowbridge's destroyers for a good couple of days. Aboard one of those destroyers was a young officer by the name of Andrew Cunningham. And at this stage of proceedings, Trowbridge had signalled, "Unless further information is received, I propose to arrive off either Fano or Faro Island at daylight. I do not propose to engage him in the middle of the Straits of Otranto, my instructions being against it. If Goeben wishes to fight, I shall endeavour to make use of shoal waters off possibly Fano Island, with the text isn't exactly clear, to choose my own range." At this point, Trowbridge, as you might have guessed, still thought there was a chance Goeben was heading for the Adriatic. But shortly after this, Gloucester informed him that the German ship was actually heading roughly south. Over the next half hour or so, consistent updates made it clear that Goeben was heading away from the Adriatic and was in fact heading roughly southeast. And so at 10 minutes past midnight, Milne put about and headed south to try and intercept, estimating that he'd cut the German ship off at around 0600 local time. Since this, of course, meant that cruisers would come past the bay where the destroyers were waiting, he ordered them to meet up with him. Although the destroyers set out by limiting themselves to 21 knots to conserve what little fuel they had until it was really needed. Just after 0300, he signalled, "I'm endeavouring to cross bows of Goeben by 6 a.m. and intend to engage her if possible. Be prepared to form a line of bearing, turning into line ahead as required. If we have not cut him off, I may retire behind Zante to avoid a long-range action." Local dawn would start at 0400. Given that Trowbridge would later claim that Goeben, in daylight, constituted a superior force to his own, this plan might therefore seem a little bit odd, but given that the sun would still be low in the sky, it would initially still be a viable tactic, as with the sun rising behind Trowbridge, there'd be a window where there was enough light to see and engage the Germans, but if the Germans were trying to get rangefinders for their targets, they would be directing their rangefinders into the low sun, which would blind them, and thus buy the British time to close. Word of this planned engagement spread through Trowbridge's forces, and the men on both the cruisers and the destroyers were rather looking forward to it. Although, as dawn approached, only three destroyers remained closing on the rendezvous point, one of which was Cunningham's, as these were the only three that still had enough fuel left to keep up and fight. Part of the issue was that nobody at this point actually seemed to think that a run to the Ottoman Empire was on the cards. Betting was ranging from Goeben trying to attack Egypt and the Suez Canal, to raiding shipping lanes south of Greece and north of Crete, or trying to draw off the British so that Goeben could then loop back and sail to join the Austro-Hungarian fleet. Also, as Goeben's course drew her still further south, the prospect of an engagement in full daylight began to grow as the rate of closure began to drop. This was coupled with some rather fanciful ideas about the Germans' gun range, crediting them with 26 to 28,000 yard ranges at a time in the war when, thanks to elevation limits, their actual gun range was a little under 20,000 yards. Conversely, Trowbridge's 9.2 and 7.5 inch guns had maximum ranges of about 15 to 16,000 yards, depending on which gun and which mounting was in use. Of course, maximum and actual effective ranges were very different matters, both in terms of where you could effectively hit and when you could effectively punch through armour. Generally, British doctrine of this period said that armoured cruisers' gunnery was unlikely to be effective much past 13,000 yards, and some officers of the cruiser squadron pointed out that none of the ships had engaged in anything further than 8,000 yards in recent gunnery practice. German effective range was, of course, also somewhat less than their maximum range, but it was still going to be somewhat further than that of the armoured cruisers. Some hope was, of course, being placed in Dublin, with the idea that if she could land a torpedo hit, it might slow the German ship down. But when it turned out that overnight she'd only been able to find Breslau, that hope went away. Based on what they thought Goeben could do, irrespective of what she could actually do, Captain Ray spoke with Trowbridge around 0330, in part stating, "Do not see what you can do, sir. There are two courses open to the Goeben. One was directly on sight of you to circle round at a radius of the visibility of the time, and the other course was for her to circle round you at some range outside 16,000 yards, which her guns could carry and your guns will not. It seems to me this is likely to be the suicide of the squadron." Towards the end of the conversation, Ray recorded this exchange. "Before I went up to the navigator, the Admiral said, 'I cannot turn away now, think of my pride.' I said to him, 'Has your pride got anything to do with this, sir? It's your country's welfare which is at stake.' After he had decided to turn away, I went down to him and I said, 'Admiral, that is the bravest thing you have ever done in your life.' And so, at 0347, the 1st Cruiser Squadron turned away from potential action and the prospect of engaging Goeben was over. She would, of course, manage to make it to the Dardanelles eventually." Trowbridge later stated that if he had persisted, the Goeben would sight the squadron on her port bow, distant 20 to 25 miles. She would then pursue one of two alternatives. If desirous of proceeding to her destination at all costs, she would pass round the squadron in 1 hour and 20 minutes at a distance of 12.5 miles, and then resume her original course. On the other hand, she could, in less time, pass the squadron at a distance of from 15 to 16,000 yards and resume her course. At that range, the squadron could not, unless by some extraordinary chance, expect to hit her. Contrarywise, she could, with her guns and speed, maintain her range and without any doubt inflict much damage, or even destruction, on the squadron. He would then signal Milne. "Being only able to meet Goeben outside the range of our guns and inside his, I have abandoned the chase with my squadron and request instructions for light cruisers. Goeben evidently going to the Eastern Mediterranean. I had hoped to meet her before daylight." For some reason, it took almost an hour to actually encode and send this message to Milne, and by the time he had any chance of reply, any chance of resuming the chase was well and truly gone. So, was this decision justified? As said at the start, much discussion was had from the moment the escape of the German ships became clear all the way down to today. But given the assumptions about the two sides' relative capabilities, it would seem a reasonable choice. There was precious little point in letting Goeben pick apart 1st Cruiser Squadron at leisure. About all that would do would deplete German ammunition stocks, which, to be fair, might have turned out to be quite useful in the long run, but no one knew how long the war would last just yet. But, given the factors we've mentioned, what might actually have happened in retrospect? Well, for one thing, despite their best efforts, Goeben's crew only managed to stock their bunkers with about 600 tons of poor quality coal, which was just enough to reach the Dardanelles at cruising speed. In the event, the Germans would refuel from a collier off the Greek coast, but if Souchon had faced prospective action and been forced to ramp up his power output from cruising to maximum speed, with fuel consumption thus increasing by a factor of 4 to 5 times, he would be at a huge risk, as even a few hours of such running could cut a day or more off of the ship's cruising range, assuming she took no damage, meaning that they'd have to make that collier rendezvous with minimal coal left in the bunkers, or the ship would actually be left adrift. And again, that's assuming she didn't take any hits that flooded coal bunkers, knocked out boilers, or caused additional drag just by making holes underwater. There's also the fact that he'd actually have to bring his ship up to whatever his top speed was from the 17 to 18 knots that he was doing at the time. And then, of course, how fast could he actually go? While the British, as we've seen, thought the Goeben to be swift enough to circle around them, if we take Souchon's word, albeit that that is a rather low outlier, then that 18-knot speed that he was cruising at was actually also his maximum speed, and Troubridge's squadron was 2 knots faster. And Troubridge's speed advantage might actually have grown if he'd decided to detach his one slightly slower armoured cruiser once battle was joined. Even if we take the majority spread, which would seem to indicate that the ship could at least sustain 20 to 21 knots, and maybe a little bit faster on occasion above that, it would mean that Goeben's speed was practically the same as Troubridge's squadron, or again, if Troubridge detached his troublesome cruiser, perhaps telling it to take one flank and the other three headed on down the other, then three of Troubridge's ships would still be a knot or two faster, and that would say nothing of the three destroyers who were able to make it to the rendezvous point. Adding to this further, if Troubridge tried to close the range, then to circle around him, Goeben would have needed a significant speed advantage to prevent the range from closing, and so either Goeben would have to retreat, heading back west, and thus only able to bring some guns to bear, and closing back on Milne, or else Goeben would somehow need to sustain 24 to 25 knots or more, and it seems evident that she was very unlikely to be able to do this. And thus, if Goeben tried to circle around, Troubridge would be able to close the range. Then you get to the matter of armour penetration. Although Goeben undoubtedly carried armour that was capable of shrugging off 9.2 inch and 7.5 inch AP shellfire at all but the closest ranges, it's actually quite interesting that when you look at the German specifications for their shells at the time, if you assume that Troubridge was aiming to close with his opponent, the 11-inch guns wouldn't actually reliably punch through the British cruiser's main belts until the range closed to 13 to 14,000 yards. Now, of course, 11-inch hits outside of that would wreck anything that wasn't protected by the 6-inch armour, but truly dangerous levels of penetration to the magazines or the machinery wouldn't occur until Goeben entered a range at which the British armoured cruisers could in fact hit back. Reasonably, effectively, and assuming that those British cruisers opened up using high explosive or CPC shells on the basis that they weren't going to be able to punch through with armour-piercing shells, except on the really, really thinly protected parts of Goeben's distributed armour, the sheer weight of fire might well start breaking things, like rangefinders and secondary guns, and setting various things on fire, like the bridge, and this might reduce the Germans' combat effectiveness. And then as the range closed, the armour-piercing shells could start to become reasonably effective against anything that wasn't Goeben's main turrets and main belt armour. And of course, this is discounting the potential of torpedo attack by the three destroyers, or in the relatively unlikely event that an armoured cruiser or two got close enough, the armoured cruisers themselves. Additionally, German evasion of incoming destroyers or their torpedoes would of course throw off their fire control solution for some time, thus improving the survival chances of the armoured cruisers. Now, the flip side to all of this, which makes it sound like perhaps Trippridge should have engaged, is that the British had practiced for two ships concentrating their fire on a single target, but not for four ships concentrating their fire on a single target, and that of course could lead to some problems if all four cruisers went for Goeben at once. And of course, if the range dropped to 10 to 12,000 yards, Goeben would be able to devastate any of the armoured cruisers that it fired on, as long as it got a decent range bracket. However, flipping things around once again, Trowbridge didn't necessarily have to win. He had to damage Goeben enough that she could be easily overhauled. Whereas Souchon, on the other hand, couldn't really afford to take much damage at all, or expend significant amounts of ammunition, or delay all that much in time, or significantly increase his fuel consumption. But equally, you know, taking out multiple British ships would be quite the feather in his cap. So, when all these factors are considered, although given the assumptions made at the time by both sides, Trowbridge was probably technically correct in not engaging, if he had chosen to engage anyway, for whatever reason, maybe hoping to at least buy time for Milne to get moving, he would actually likely find the odds somewhat better than both he and many others since have assumed. Now, any single armoured cruiser would, of course, still be at a huge disadvantage, but that's what weight of numbers is for. Remember that a few months later, at the Battle of the Falkland Islands, even with much better odds and significantly more powerful guns, the two British battle cruisers involved there had to keep a reasonable distance from the Scharnhorsts in order to sink them without suffering too much damage in exchange, and that did take quite some time to accomplish. So, with all that in mind, I decided to play out this scenario using the tabletop wargame Broadsides Empires of Steel, as it's fairly detailed, but also relatively quick in terms of naval wargaming systems, and it's targeted at exactly this period. The Broadsides team were kind enough to send some rather lovely ships my way, representing the scenario, although I'm going to end up using Dublin and her two destroyers as a stand-in for the three destroyers that would have included Andrew Cunningham, and would have actually have been there, but since the rules card for Beagle and Bulldog represents the same class of destroyer, we're going to be okay. Compared to the listed statistics, I decided to knock one speed point off of Goeben to represent that she's a bit slowed, that gives her more realistic top speed, around about 20 to 21 knots, maybe a bit more. I also knocked a speed point off of Warrior to represent that she was going pretty slowly as well. This leaves the other three armoured cruisers with roughly the same speed as Goeben, but the battlecruiser can change speed twice as quickly in the game, which means that since everyone's going to be starting at speed 3, representing a cruising speed of around 18 knots, which we know both sides were doing, Goeben would be able to get a little bit of a speed boost early on, and potentially keep that speed advantage if Trowbridge's ships all stick together. To represent the initial starting conditions, Goeben will be on one side of the game table, heading across it, and the armoured cruisers will be heading along the game table at a slight angle, with the destroyers somewhat further ahead. Goeben, of course, will be aiming to keep the gunfire in the longer range band if possible, while Trowbridge will be trying to close in order to become more effective. The game deals with issues like target size, angle of fire, armour, etc., etc., but if you want a full breakdown, there will be an accompanying video of the entire playthrough here, but here's some edited highlights. The game started off with Goeben coming in perpendicular to the long table edge on one side, Trowbridge's armoured cruisers coming in from one corner on the other side, mostly, as we said, heading perpendicular, but with a little angle in, and the destroyers somewhat further up, almost crossing Goeben's T. Souchon then decided, well, closing into that mess of ships is a bad idea, and of course his objective is to try and get past them, so he started off by coming about, so turning to starboard, which also unmasked his broadside, and then increasing his speed. Trowbridge initially tried to increase speed on his ships as fast as he could. Of course, his acceleration is a little bit slower. Both sides opened fire as they'd begun to enter the maximum range of their guns, which I decided was relatively reasonable because in these conditions, the two forces had been closing mostly at night. And as we said, initially, you'd have the sun rising behind Trowbridge's ships, which would have made them harder to spot. So we assumed that really this scenario is beginning with both sides establishing, hey, the other side there, at a range where both sides can just about begin to shoot at each other. The destroyers, meanwhile, laid smoke to avoid being shot at and moved to try and cut off Goeben by crossing her T. The engagement started out relatively well for the British as defence managed to land a number of hits on Goeben. However, these hits were only enough to cause some superficial damage as they weren't strong enough to breach Goeben's main armour, and although this did knock some of Goeben's systems down a little bit, Goeben was able to return fire in exchange. This running fight continued as Goeben continued to turn away somewhat from the British cruisers, maintaining fire at long distance, and as the range gradually closed, as Trowbridge decided that charging directly at Goeben, while it would close the range somewhat quicker, would also mean that Goeben would be eventually moving out to his port side and then he wouldn't be able to chase him down, so a slightly slower closing in range would allow him to bring more fire to bear more immediately. But this didn't work out too well because Goeben managed to get range and hit defence hard enough that defence was sent from full health to a sinking condition in one massive set of salvos. That wasn't a brilliant thing to occur. The remaining three British cruisers pressed on. Warrior was gradually left behind with her slower speed, continuing to exchange gunfire. However, one of the critical mistakes that Trowbridge, aka me, made in this early part was everyone tried to fire, and that meant that there were multiple shell splashes, and that actually obscured the ability of the British ships to continue firing. Whereas perhaps if after the initial salvo, when defence got some hits, she'd been the only one to continue firing and the others had waited, she might have been able to score at least one more salvo before her demise. Now, Goeben continued to fire, but was facing a little bit of a problem because the destroyers managed to cut ahead of her and make two launch torpedoes. Goeben decided, well, if she turned broadside, so turning to port or starboard, she would be able to engage the destroyers with more of her secondary battery, but also would make a much bigger, more obvious torpedo target. And of course, if she turns to port, she'd be closing the range on the British armoured cruisers, giving them more of a chance. If she turned away, she'd be withdrawing back the way she came, which wasn't particularly great. And so Souchon decided to keep his bow pointed at the destroyers to minimise his target profile and hope on his secondary guns. This actually worked out somewhat because the first destroyer, the closest, launched its torpedoes, missed, and was also crippled quite badly by secondary gunfire from Goeben. The main batteries then managed to find the range on Black Prince, and Black Prince was destroyed in short order, much as defence had been. Goeben then finished off the damaged destroyer and moved on to shoot at the second of the three destroyers, damaging it as well. However, at this point, the two destroyers had managed to get close enough that with a combined salvo of torpedoes, they managed to score a single hit, which caused flooding and actually took some chunks out of Goeben's health pool, which obviously wasn't brilliant for Goeben. However, they were now out of torpedoes on their engaged side and had to try and come about rapidly to drop their other torpedoes. Goeben, however, managed to cut through this, destroying the second destroyer, which she'd already damaged previously with her secondary battery, leaving just one destroyer to come and try and swing about to unleash another set of torpedoes from her port side. The British armoured cruisers, now down to just two, continue to try and engage Goeben, but most of the exchanges of fire between both sides have been relatively ineffective, so not much occurred. And at that point, Goeben had managed to reach the board edge, so the destroyer, while theoretically in another couple of turns could have swung around to drop off another set of torpedoes, she probably wouldn't have lasted against Goeben's secondary battery at that kind of close range. And the two British remaining armoured cruisers were now somewhat behind Goeben and unable to really close the distance. And so the battle ended there with Souchon having managed to get away. Now, as many had might have expected, this has cost the British quite significantly, 2 destroyers down and 2 armoured cruisers sunk. Whether or not Trowbridge was a casualty, I kind of leave up to your judgment. He could have gotten off his sinking ship, possibly, but there still would have been quite a lot of lives lost. The one saving grace of this is not necessarily that the armoured cruisers managed to do all that much, but the destroyer torpedo hit did leave Goeben flooding for a while, and so Goeben was significantly slowed going out of the scenario. Now, she did manage to repair the worst of the flooding during the game, but reverting back to what would have happened afterwards, with a torpedo hole in her, she wasn't going to go anywhere particularly quickly, much like Bismarck had to slow after she took a torpedo hit. So too would Goeben, and of course she'd be weighed down. Where exactly that torpedo hit was would also affect things, because in the bow it would slow her quite a bit. More along amidships, it wouldn't slow her quite as much because of the hole and the flooding, because obviously she wouldn't be bowed down, but could have resulted in flooding to one of her precious coal bunkers or flooding in her, one of her machinery spaces. But generally speaking, Goeben's speed and range is going to be much reduced, which means that especially if Trowbridge or his successor signals, hey, look, we've just engaged Goeben, he's gotten away, but she was hit by torpedoes and is limping, it's fairly likely Milne's battlecruisers would have been able to hunt her down, which overall probably would have resulted in the destruction of Goeben before she got to the Ottoman Empire, but it comes at a fairly high cost from Trowbridge's squadron. I'm actually very pleased with the way that scenario worked out. I did make 1 or 2 mistakes in my tactics, I think. I could have maybe done a little bit more damage to Goeben, but then again, those kind of mistakes are also relatively coherent with the way that the scenario might well have played out in real life. So, yeah, at least based on that, maybe Trowbridge should have engaged. I think it pretty much comes down to, is it worth losing a couple of armoured cruisers and a couple of destroyers for the chance for Milne to get his act together and sink Goeben? On the grand face of it, that could be seen to a certain degree as an even trade at the time, because of course they don't know what this is going to all lead to, but on a grand strategic scale in hindsight, if the lack of Goeben being able to get to the Dardanelles meant that the Ottomans didn't enter the war and therefore you didn't get the Gallipoli landings and so forth, it might well be seen in retrospect nowadays as a very, very worthwhile sacrifice. And of course, you know, that scenario could play out several times with the game, and it may end up going very different ways each time. So I'll leave that up to you. You let me know in the comments, do you think based on this outcome, Trowbridge should have engaged, or was he wise not to? And if you'd like to pick up Broadsize Empires of Steel, well, there's a link in the video description below, and they are also doing an expansion soon, because obviously at the moment it's focused primarily around World War One, but they're also, retro-expanding backwards into the pre-Dreadnought era as well. More details on that to come in a video in the future. And as I said, the full gameplay, including the explanation of the rules and the playthrough turn by turn, will be coming up later this week. Bye for now.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.